Hello and welcome to Volume 114 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about the use of drones in forestry. We'll talk about Kogan grass. We'll discuss changes in law enforcement that affects forestry. And as always, we'll check on the timber market and how it's behaving. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is an attorney who has experience in representing private landowners as they face issues dealing with endangered species. His name is Chris Jones. Welcome, Chris.
Yes, thank you.
Chris, many forest owners are afraid to talk about endangered species on their property. How can you help them, and why would someone need somebody like you?
Sure, Mr. Brown. First, all my conversations with people are strictly confidential. I represent the landowner. For example, if they receive a letter from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service suggesting an endangered species lives on their land, and to first get their permission before doing a prescribed burn, mid-story removal, thinning a stand, or cutting trees for a timber sale, the government claims these forestry practices may take an endangered species like red-cockaded woodpeckers, red hill salamanders. Today, 140 federal endangered species exist in Alabama, but most forest owners don't realize the feds are considering enlisting another 136 species in the cotton state by the year 2018. Unfortunately, many of these species should not be listed as endangered because populations are healthy and prevalent in the wild, but the feds are only suggesting their protection after being sued by wealthy environmental groups who claim to be scientists but are truly anti-hunting, anti-sustainable harvest, and have really corrupted the endangered listing process. I help landowners officially comment against unnecessary endangered listings. I also help preserve private property rights if an endangered species already exists on that land.
Can you give me an idea of the range of the types of endangered species you work with and the type of wildlife law cases you participate in?
Sure. Last year, interestingly, I represented Mr. Coonrippy Brown in Tennessee, who had his domesticated raccoon confiscated and killed by the state wildlife department. Mr. Brown got so mad at government waste and corruption, he ran for governor and came second place. I also represented a Kentucky Pentecostal serpent pastor in his National Geographic show, Snake Salvation, while passing through Tennessee and had his legally acquired rattlesnakes from Alabama illegally confiscated and killed by the same wildlife department. I've helped cattlemen associations maintain grazing rights in national forests and defend families wrongfully accused of violating the Endangered Species Act. I also help private breeders of animals and their efforts bringing a species away from extinction, and help people who possess and sell taxidermy.
You mentioned a couple of cases, wildlife departments, state wildlife departments that affect forest landowners. Do you see the role of these wildlife departments changing in any way?
Very much so. In the last 5 years even, I'll say there's a rush to judgment trend right now in many wildlife departments criminalizing the legal commercial animal trade and taxidermy, largely because directors are not screening their employees and researchers who have animal rights agendas. We've got to ensure our agency folks are aligned with our Constitution and encouraging sustainable harvest, which is the original purpose of creating the Wildlife Department in the first place about 100 years ago. Departments are seeking to justify their existence in a modern world under the auspices of animal welfare, endangered species protection, and an exaggerated and even fictional black market wildlife trade.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. We appreciate that perspective.
My pleasure.
Nancy Lowenstein is a research fellow with the Auburn University School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences, and is an invasive plant specialist with the Alabama Cooperative Extension. Much of her work has been working to eradicate Kogan grass. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
We know that Kogan grass is a notorious invasive plant, but what is it about Kogan grass that makes it so difficult to control?
So, Kogan grass is a very aggressive grower, and most of its biomass is actually underground in rhizomes that will sprout, and it's unless you kill all of those rhizomes, it will continue to sprout back, and that makes it difficult to control. And there's been a lot of research over the years that shows that glyphosate and imazapyr will control Kogan grass, but what we haven't had is research that shows exactly what it takes to completely eradicate it.
Okay, tell us about what some of your research is showing about complete eradication.
So we started some studies to look at whether you could use annual treatments of glyphosate and imazapyr to eradicate it, whether combining imazapyr and glyphosate works better than using either one alone, whether the timing of application of the herbicide made any difference, and whether the energy level and depth of the rhizomes changed as you applied the herbicides. So we put a study in at two different sites in Mobile and found that actually the time to eradication varied by site. But then a single application of glyphosate per year reduced the rhizomes, but that it did not lead to eradication. But if imazapyr did work after 3 years of application, as did a combination of glyphosate and imazapyr. But combining the two actually didn't buy you anything over using glyphosate alone.
Okay.
Also found that the rhizome depth and energy level didn't change with the herbicide applications.
What do you think is next in the eradication of Kogan grass?
Well, what we were really interested in is the differences in site that we saw, especially with the glyphosate. So what we're doing now is looking at whether there are genotypic differences in the response to glyphosate. So we've got over 90 collections of rhizome or collections of Kogan grass from around the southeast and beyond that we're going to be screening for response to glyphosate.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Nancy. We appreciate that. We'll try to keep in touch with you about that process and all your research. Thank you.
Thank you.
AFOA offers its members the opportunity to purchase two types of insurance. One is for hunting club liability, and the other is more generally timberland liability. There were also wildfires, 1,682 wildfires in 2013, and some caused serious damage. So today we're going to talk to Tom Skaggs with Outdoor Underwriters about standing timber fire damage insurance. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Yeah, we have because of the demand, we developed a new product for AFOA members where they can purchase standing timber insurance for fire, the peril of fire. So if your trees catch fire and burn up, we can pick up that coverage for you. There's several limit options available. This is designed for smaller woodland owners, and we have set limits with a per acre limit and a very small deductible and a very small premium. The limits for this program, you can buy $2,500 worth of coverage for $15 in premium, $5,000 worth of coverage for $30 in premium, and $25,000 worth of coverage for $110 in premium.
This is annual premium, correct?
This is an annual premium, correct.
All right, tell us about the, you mentioned limits. Those are total damage limits, okay? Is there a
correct
per acre limit, or is there some
there
sort
is,
of limit on the total acres covered?
There is a per acre limit. On the $2,500 total limit, there's a $500 per acre limit. That $500 per acre limit also applies to the $5,000 total coverage limit. On the $25,000 limit, it is $750. Now, we do have higher limits available. You can purchase $50,000 worth of coverage or up to $100,000 worth of coverage, but those we have to underwrite individually and price separately. This is a cookie-cutter type approach with set premiums. Now, they cannot exceed no one tract can exceed 200 acres for this particular program.
Okay, so small landowners, if 200 acres is considered small. But what types
Correct.
Of forest cover is most sensitive to wildfire?
Well, the answer would be all of them, depending on the conditions. But primarily pine is going to be the first one that's going to be hit because of the flashier fuel. You have a greater flashy fuel on the woodland floor, and during severe drought periods, that's where you're going to see significant losses.
Okay. These coverages start at a certain date when it's the effective date of the policy. Tell us how a landowner goes about selecting these dates on when to get one of these things started.
Because of the way we've structured this, and we're trying to have a ease of application process and then an ease from an administrative process, we have two annual policies. The first annual policy begins on January 1st, and it is an annual policy. The second policy begins in June 1st, so you have two different sign-up periods. Now, that's not to say that you cannot purchase this coverage anytime during the year. You can, but just know that it's 100% earned premium up front, and you may be shorted a few months the first time you buy it, but then once you hit your renewal date, it'll be annual in nature. But please keep in mind you're paying anywhere from $15 to $110 for this coverage.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom. We appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Roger Bryan is a consulting forester and a software engineer from Smyrna, Georgia. So we asked him to give us some information about new technologies for our smartphones that we carry in our pockets when we're in the woods. Welcome, Roger.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Dave.
Today's smartphones are as powerful as many computers were several years ago. What makes them a good tool for forest landowners?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is their mobility, and we typically have our phone with us everywhere we go. So always in our pocket, we're going to have a data collection tool, whether you're collecting GPS data, field data, picture data, for example. We always have a camera with us, and the mountain of apps that are available for our phones these days is tremendous. And so it's a good tool to have with you, and especially when you're in the woods.
Okay. Well, tell us about some of the apps that you think all of us should have on our smartphones.
Well, I've kind of got it narrowed down into like two or three categories, but for a forest landowner, it's always good to have some kind of GPS collection. Collection app. So say you want to know how many acres or you have on your pond, or you've just harvested an area, or you have a food plot and you'd have someone manage that for you. You want to know the acreage. There's a great app called Smart for Android, and it's by a French team of developers, but it's in English, so don't worry. It's easy to use. It's the one I go to the most from my phone. I also carry a Bluetooth GPS receiver that kind of syncs with my phone, and I use that as well. For iOS, GIS Kit, even though it's not really for your phone, it's more of a tablet app, is my favorite app probably of all time for any GIS or GPS mapping, and it is primarily for an iPad. So if you have like an iPad mini, that's a great field app. Navigation wise, this has nothing to do with forestry at all, but I think everybody should probably have Waze, W-A-Z-E. It is a great app. I use it every day. I can't drive anywhere now without it. It tells me, it gives me information about my trip, whether I'm riding around town or heading out to the woods. It lets me know if there's traffic ahead, if there's an accident. It even lets me know if there are police around. And so it's a crowdsourced information. So Waze is probably my app of 2014. As we move into a new year, for last year, that's probably my favorite app. And then because we all have cameras on our smartphones, I think some sort of geotagging camera application, you could do some searches on that in any of the app stores, and you'll find a plethora of them. My favorite one in Android is called GeoCam Free, and it actually has some tools that will actually allow you to calculate the height of a tree as well. So it's a really cool app using your camera. But what this will do, it'll allow you to take pictures of things in your woods, on your property. So say you're tracking wildlife signs and where deer's been rubbing, you can actually post those pictures on a map and actually get trends of what's on the property and where and timing, and you know, quite a few out there for iOS as well. So I think a good geotagging camera app that integrates with Google Maps or some other mapping application would be super handy.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for those tips, Roger. We appreciate that.
No problem.
Continuing with our technology theme, we have Jim Furbotten, who's a consulting forester from Aberdeen, Washington. He's getting more and more involved in unmanned aerial vehicles. You might be more familiar with the term drones. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning.
Jim, what uses do these unmanned aerial vehicles have in forestry?
You know, I think it's pretty much unlimited. Right now for us, basically, we've been using them a lot for basically any forestry aspects that you do, pre and post cruising on logging utilization for one. We're even looking into maybe putting a FLIRS unit on one of our ships so we can fly hotspots for fires. We're using them for mass erosion, depletion of gravel pits, silviculture, you know, an overall lay, how well your stocking level is. And we also are involved in the hunt leases. That's a big thing, a new thing out here in the Pacific Northwest. And we found them somewhat useful for that. And also locally for search and rescue, some opportunities open up to maybe help them folks out also.
Can you give us an idea of the cost of these units? And I understand some have fixed wings and some are helicopter type. So tell us something about cost.
Well, the cost on these, the drones like we use versus fixed wing, when I say fixed wing, I mean actual airplanes. The hourly rates, you know, for them when we use them for aerial photos or whatever, from $200 to $400 an hour. Helicopters have gone up tremendously. We use them a lot for fisheries surveys and whatnot, and they're about $950 an hour. Versus every consultant's charging a little bit different, but average of $100 an hour, $130 an hour to go over and do the same work with your drone. The advantages we have with the drone is our elevation. We can fly from 2 feet to 400 feet, keeping it safe. And, you know, we can get a lot more visibility and flexibility flying these.
Aren't these already being extensively used in agricultural applications?
They are, and even more so, the state of Oregon is really setting the precedence, getting this thing ramped up. They are working with the local farmers because you can, you know, fly over their fields and find spots where maybe the fertilizer or the watering systems are missing. You can cover a lot of ground with these. We can do plot-by-plot mapping, program these to fly where they'll take off. We hit the go button, and they'll go to all these different spots and return to home. And so just numerous uses with them right now.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Earlier this year, the law enforcement responsibilities for dozens of state agencies, including the Alabama Forestry Commission, were merged into a single agency called the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency. And within that agency is a unit called the Agriculture and Rural Crime Unit, which is where forestry crimes would be handled. We have Sergeant Ira Whitehead, who's a special agent assigned to this unit, to explain how this works. Welcome, Sergeant Whitehead.
Good morning, sir.
Tell us about the role of the Agriculture and Rural Crime Unit.
The unit, Ira, we fall under the State Bureau of Investigations, which is a division of the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency. Our unit, the investigators that work for the Forestry Commission have been transferred into our agriculture unit, our investigation unit. And the unit assists local law enforcement agencies with investigations that relate to agriculture crimes, which does include timber and examples of timber thefts, livestock and equipment thefts. That's the primary mission. We assist the local agencies. The unit was started approximately a year and a half ago, and we've been pretty successful, and we hope to continue doing that with the addition of the forestry investigators. The forestry investigators, like I say, we will continue to investigate the timber thefts. The arson fires that the forestry investigators investigated, that duty will actually be transferred to the state fire marshal's office. So the state fire marshal will handle the forestry arson, the criminal fire calls. But so far, the unit has been very successful. In the small time we've been up and running, we've covered over $2 million worth of equipment, and numerous arrests have been made assisting local agents throughout the state.
How does someone report a crime or contact your unit?
Well, the first thing is if there's an immediate need for assistance. We're not a 911 agency. We're not the first responder. So any citizen would need to immediately call 911, which that should go to a 911 call center or to your local sheriff or a police department. That would be the first thing that you would need to do. The second thing, once a crime has occurred, as far as getting in touch with the Agricultural and Rural Crime Unit, we have a 1-855-75-CRIME phone number that a person can call into. Currently, that number rings in over at the Alabama Department of Agriculture. You may have to leave a message, but someone will get in touch with you. It's forwarded out to an investigator. That will be changing within a week. That number should go to the ALEA Headquarters Communication Call Center, and you should be able to get someone there 24 hours a day.
So it's the same number, it's just routed somewhere else.
Correct. It's just we're fixing it. With the consolidation, we're trying to get it all in line, and then it will be rerouted. The next one, another good way, everybody's computer literate nowadays, is go to ALEA website, which is www.alea.gov. Once you bring up the home page, you can look over to the right in the quick link section and click on the Rural Crime Unit or Report Rural Crime. Once that page opens, you'll see a big box there, a red box, where you can report rural crime. Once you click on it, you go through there and you fill out a form, a suspicious activity form, leaving your name, phone number, and the purpose of your call. That will be routed to one of the investigators, and they will get in touch with you.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
One number I did want to mention in conjunction with the fire marshals, they requested that we put this number out as far as reporting arson activity, was 1-800-654-0775, 1-800-654-0775, and that will be the arson tip line that will ring directly into the state fire marshal's office.
All right, good. Well, we wish you well, Sergeant Whitehead. We appreciate you being on the program with us.
All right, thank you.
Americans who are not directly involved in forestry often have only one interaction with a tree grower each year, and that's the local cut-your-own Christmas tree grower. Mike Burkhart is the Executive Secretary of the Southern Christmas Tree Association, which includes Alabama. Welcome, Mike.
Good day to you.
Why do you advocate going to your local Christmas tree farm?
Well, it's certainly the opportunity to purchase the freshest of fresh Christmas trees, but more importantly is the experience that an individual or family can have when they go to a choose-and-cut operation. The whole experience for the day or for a couple hours is very rewarding. We find that people enjoy that and enjoy going back every year and continuing on with the family tradition. But it's most importantly is the experience that you have going out to work and farm and going and cutting your tree. I remember as a kid, I still think about it nowadays, is, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be walking through a field somewhere or snowbound mountainside and cut your own Christmas tree? Well, obviously we don't have the snow environment down here, but we can certainly provide opportunity for people to go out and enjoy the countryside and choose and cut their tree.
Is growing Christmas trees a money-making proposition?
Well, it's yes. You can put your land in production and benefit from that. But don't be misled or misunderstood that the money is there for the easy pick and that you just plant the tree and come back a few years later and harvest the benefits and the profits. It's not like that. It's a working farm. There's a lot of things involved which cost money, time, and effort. And you need to be serious about growing Christmas trees if you're going to do this. It's not something to just walk away from and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the experienced growers know how much work's involved. We're available to help people make that decision to get into the venture. So is it profitable? Yes, it's profitable. There's people continuing to do it every year. Every year they don't just do it just to provide smiles and happiness for everybody. They do it for a reason, to stay in business and put money back into their land. So, yes, it's attractive, but you have to have certain things, land, good access to equipment, people you can depend on, the willingness to work hard and long hours, even during extreme heat and extreme cold, a place that can handle numbers of people passing through. So, yeah, it's good for the right people.
What are some of the problems associated with tree growing?
Well, in the South, we have a growing environment pretty much, 10 months out of the year. So that means something's always going on out there, which means you have vegetative and insect competition all the time. So you have to deal with competition. You have to deal with various insects and diseases. Being in the South, we have a number of those. We certainly have weather environments just like any farming operation where ice storms or wind storms or hurricanes or severe rains can direly affect what's happening to that Christmas tree. You've got to have good soil drainage. So there's a number of challenges. It's not, we don't have any magic trees where you plant it and poof, it makes a Christmas tree. You have to manage it constantly, including shearing, sometimes irrigation, sometimes fertilization. Definitely treatment for competition. So there's a lot of work involved all year long.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mike. Our Marcus chair is Bob Abt, the professor, a professor at North Carolina State. Welcome, Bob.
Glad to be here.
Bob, we've got you in our Marcus chair today, and we wanted to talk to you about the difference between sawtimber and pulpwood prices. Traditionally, sawtimber prices are 4 or 5 times pulpwood prices, so forest owners typically take income from an immediate thinning for pulpwood, but their byproduct, what they're ultimately geared toward, is sawtimber. Now, I understand the price difference between these two products is changing. Can you tell us what's happening?
Yeah, it's interesting times. I think most people can understand why pine sawtimber prices are low, at least part of it. It's the housing recession. So a lot of lumber production's down 20-30%. Prices are down for sawtimber, maybe up to 40%. So the demand side is down. What some people may not realize is in the 80s, we had a planting boom. That was really when the plantation economy was really taking off. So we also had a sort of a wall of pine sawtimber coming into the market about the time the recession dropped. So we also have a high supply mixed with that low demand. So that's why the prices have dropped so dramatically. And what that means is that supply, a lot of that supply is out there waiting for prices to come back. And on the pulpwood side, folks in Alabama are certainly aware that the demand for hardwood-based pulp has gone down with the Cortland mill closing. That's the paper that's being replaced by computers. But paper used for packaging, that has not had a recession, so prices for pine pulp would have continued to rise through the recession. So those two things put together lead to the ratios changing quite a bit.
With these current prices that you're mentioning, and maybe this is the wrong way to look at it about current prices, but how should landowners think about changing the way that they practice forestry and practice silviculture?
So there's a couple things I want to say up front. One is, of course, you shouldn't assume that current prices are the best predictor of the long run. Planting trees is a long-run proposition, so I wouldn't panic based on the current situation. The other thing I'd like to say is it all boils down to local markets. So the decision about what to do is going to boil down to what the price differential is in your area, what your alternative investment opportunities are. This is also a low interest rate environment. So even though the price differential is low, if you can only make 2% in an alternative investment, that still may be a significant price differential. So that needs to factor into it. And, of course, your silviculture, how long it takes you to get from one product class to another changes the timing of that. So those factors are all local condition factors, partly on your silviculture, but certainly on the markets that are next to you.
Okay.
And if I was thinking about this, I would think about it not so much about changing the pulpwood, but just being flexible. So if I was next to a sawmill that was closed down and waiting for a housing to come back and chip and saw prices were high, I might go ahead and take that low price and try to get into a pulpwood market where I might plant slightly more denser so that at the first thinning I have pulpwood if I was next to a pellet plant or something like that. So it's going to boil down to sort of local conditions and your own financial situation.
As like any other investment, diversity and flexibility is a key.
Yes, and flexibility is often forgotten about in forestry. The trees are there for the long term, but you can change and react to markets in real time.
Okay, good tip. Thank you, Bob. So that's all the time we have for that this issue. Our thanks go to Chris Jones, Nancy Lowenstein, Tom Skaggs, and Roger Bryant. We also appreciate the contributions of Jim Furbotten, Ira Whitehead, Mike Burkhart, and Bob Apt. Some of the issues that forest landowners face are somewhat academic, large-scale issues like forest policy, forest health, and wildfires. But an issue becomes a problem when it happens to you, and that is when an endangered species is discovered on your place, an invasive species takes over your forest, or when a wildfire breaks out on your land. The old Boy Scout motto is no less valid today than it was 100 years ago, so studying the issues today can help you be prepared for the problems of tomorrow, and we hope this program will help. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.